Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hello, I'm Chrissy Goldrick, and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. Today I'm talking to Terry Irwin. Terry is the director of Australia Zoo, one of Australia's premier tourist attractions. She's also a TV personality, perhaps best known for the globally successful Crocodile Hunter series that she made with her late husband Steve Irwin. Terry will be talking about how she built up Australia Zoo, and she'll also share her hopes and dreams for the future, both for herself and her two children, Bindi and Robert. Well, welcome to Talking Australia. Instead of doing our recording in the stationery cupboard at Australian Geographic headquarters, we're out on the road. And I'm thrilled to be at Australia Zoo for the first time ever, my first visit to the zoo. And with me this morning is Terry Irwin, who is the director of the zoo, well known to the readers of Australian Geographic. And so welcome, Terry.
Thank you so much. This is my first ever podcast.
So
we're both doing first today.
Yeah, so we're breaking a few new sort of new ground with our podcast this morning from Australia Zoo. So we might have some external noises coming in. We might hear the odd roar of a lion or the squawking of a bird. Who knows what might happen at Australia Zoo? I'm sure that every day is full of surprises here up on the beautiful Sunshine Coast. So it's great to be here. Like I say, it's my first visit to the zoo, so I'm looking forward to a good explore of everything here later on. But right now, this morning, we're doing the podcast from the animal hospital here in the zoo. And that is actually, as far as I'm aware, the largest animal hospital in the world. Would that be right, Terry?
For a private family-run facility, yes. And we take in some years over 8,000 animals a year. So these are wild animals that have come in sick, injured, or orphaned. And then we take care of them completely from their rescue. We have a rescue unit that goes out 7 days a week to their immediate needs for first aid, and then any ongoing treatment, whether they need surgery or they need physical therapy, whatever their ongoing treatment requirements, and then finally back out into the wild. And some of the work involves research. We're studying right now the situation with koalas and chlamydia. So we're working on a vaccine with the University of the Sunshine Coast and UQ to try to come up with a vaccine so that our koalas don't succumb to that disease. We're now seeing more koalas with chlamydia and conjunctivitis than even getting hit by cars or attacked by dogs. So there's some very interesting research going on here. It's a very hands-on hospital. We have a lot of volunteers and people who come in to learn and experience this, and it's heartwarming. It's about $2.5 million a year to run. So my accountant is constantly reminding me that philanthropic endeavors need to be within one's budget. But it's a stack of fun and incredibly rewarding whenever you see an animal go back out in the wild.
Well, it's a great aspect to have to a zoo as well, isn't it? We're used to zoos being sort of centres of research on captive breeding programs and things like that. But actually to have a hospital associated with a zoo is unusual. And in this area, what you can see when you drive around is it's right out in the middle of the bush, really, isn't it, here? It's a most unusual position for a zoo to be in. And Australia Zoo is, and one of the reasons that we did a story on it a few years ago is that it's sort of I became aware that it had become one of Australia's greatest attractions for inbound tourists, and I hadn't really seen that amongst like my local, the people that I know, and the kind of travel stories that we were doing. I hadn't really seen it register, and then I sort of became aware that it was right up there with Uluru and Bondi Beach and Australia Zoo. And it really, you do get a huge number of tourists coming from overseas that come straight here. It's right on the top of the bucket list. Tell me about why you think that might be.
Well, I think Steve had everything to do with that. I think Steve's passion was reconnecting people with wildlife. And we are now discovering that people are becoming very aware of that responsibility with how they spend their tourism dollar. And it is incredibly important that when you include that wildlife component, which 70% of tourists do, that it's done in a responsible manner. And so Steve wanted to make sure that first and foremost, all of the wildlife at Australia Zoo is having a good day. And then our team was all happy, and finally that our guests are having a good time. And interestingly enough, that works so well because when you have happy animals that are enjoying every single day, then your team is proud and your visitors and guests are most impressed. So yes, I think Steve started it all, but during the heyday of our Crocodile Hunter filming in the 90s, Our skew was very interesting from a tourism point of view. So right now, and for most facilities, you're looking at about 20 to 25% international visitation. In the 90s, it was 75% international visitation, and most of those were from America. So you have to understand our normal skew is New Zealand is our number one visitor for overseas travelers because they're so close. But we were seeing North America, U.S. and Canada coming in droves. And I think Steve's passion and flair with reintroducing us to wildlife is what got everyone excited again. And now we just want to maintain his legacy. We want to continue what he started and have that same ethic that our animals come first all the time. And you do come in and you can feed a giraffe or walk with a wombat or hug a dingo, feel what a rhinoceros's lips feel like, tour our hospital, watch our doctors in action saving lives. That's what's so special about Australia Zoo. Very hands-on, very interactive, and very joyful for our wildlife.
Well, it's very clear that you share that absolute passion for wildlife, whether it's the native wildlife or whatever. And that's what we associate with Steve, of course. Absolute, total passion all wrapped up in this great bundle of energy. And it's, you know, it's just remarkable walking in here and even driving in here along Steve Irwin Way. His presence is still very much here. So going back to Steve and those early days, you found that you shared a love of wildlife, but your love of wildlife was already there. That's something that you grew up with. Tell me a little bit about growing up and how that started and how it led you on this amazing journey, which I know has had its ups and its enormous downs. I mean, that's, you know, not to be understated, but it is a wonderful contribution that you're now making. Take us right back to where it all began back in the United States.
Well, I was very lucky to be born in a relatively small town in Oregon. And Eugene is a college town, so there's always a lot of track and field and things going on. And I was really blessed at a young age to kind of find out why I'm here. And that's really special if, as individuals, we can find out our purpose and our passion in life and be able to do that. So when I was young, my dad had a number of jobs. He was in the Navy during World War II, and he became a police officer and finally was driving heavy haul trucks. So the trucks with really big loads, bridge beams and earth moving equipment and all kinds of things. So he was on the road a lot, and he would come home with little animals that needed help. He might bring home orphaned ducklings because the mother had been hit, or a seagull that had strayed off the path and needed help. And as a young person, I really started understanding how special wildlife is. And we all have an affinity with something. So it might be your dog or your cat or your goldfish, and it might be feeding the birds in your backyard or the little animal that comes and visits at night that you just fall in love with. Well, for me, the wildlife became something that I loved and kind of wanted to hang on to. So I remember the defining moment when my dad took me into my bedroom and said, "In here you have everything that you need in love. You have your toys, you have a bed, you have a beautiful window, and if we brought you your food every day and all you were able to do is stay in this room, you would have everything you needed, but you would be very sad." And I thought, I never thought of that, but you're absolutely right. No matter how joyous and special and sunlit and wonderful my bedroom was, it was my retreat, my place where I'd write in my journal or look out the window, and I didn't want that to be my whole world. And he said, wildlife is the same. You can't keep them in a box or a cage. You need to let them go back to the wild whenever possible. And I gained this unique perspective so that growing up, I had that real empathy and affinity with all living creatures. And I think that's so good for kids. If we can teach kids to love every animal, you find that kids are more accepting of every person as mm-hmm. well. And that's the kind of people we want to have around us. So when I grew up loving wildlife, I helped my dad rehabilitate all kinds of things back into the wild. But then when I became an adult on my own, that's when I started my own wildlife rehabilitation organization and founded an organization called Cougar Country, because I lived in Cougar Country in Oregon. And these beautiful mountain lions or cougars, although I never saw one in the wild, lived around us. Very secretive, very beautiful.
Yeah, tell us about
animals.
Cougars. I think, you know, the phrase has sort of come to have other connotations in recent years. Are they dangerous? I mean, are they like a wild lion that you would try and avoid? Or are they just something that if you see it, you're just lucky to have seen one?
Yeah, well, I think both definitions of the word probably mean that there's some danger involved in either case
Watch
with
out.
A cougar. But the cougars or mountain lions were referred to by First Nation people as spirits of the mountains because you often had a sense they were there but rarely saw them. They're very secretive and shy. And a wonderful photographer was once able to climb a tree with a big male cougar and get photographs sharing the same tree because they are very uninclined to attack. And when it does happen, and it very rarely happens, often it's a cougar that may be injured or unable to hunt properly that's coming near civilization and interfering with people. But for the most part, they're very misunderstood. And my calling seemed to be predatory mammals. So I worked with cougars and bears and foxes and bobcats and raccoons and all kinds of things, basically any mammal that ate meat.
Is that because Oregon, is that to do with where it is? Oregon, is it a wild state?
Absolutely. And in Oregon, we have the Cascade Mountains and the coastal mountains. So the Cascades are kind of like the Rocky Mountains' little brother. You know, they're not quite as huge, but they're beautiful and snow-covered and spectacular. Mm-hmm. And therefore, with all the wilderness area, Oregon is 96,000 square miles and goes everything from high desert regions, mountainous regions, to coastal fringe areas. So there's a real diversified wildlife population. And I've just found an affinity with predatory mammals, and not many people were working with them because, yes, of course, you know, bears are big and they bite and you know, it's a little bit more dangerous, but I just kind of found that was what I was good at working with. And I remember the really sad day when someone brought me a little rabbit, and this was kind of a turning point for me, a little baby cottontail. And cottontail rabbits are so interesting because a lot of baby animals eat constantly. So you're setting your alarm and getting up every 2 hours through the night and trying to be a mother, whatever. But cottontails are different. You feed them twice a day. So I was like, sweet, this is going to be easy. Rabbits are so simple. And I held the beautiful little cottontail in my hands that someone had found. And I said, don't worry, I'll make sure to take good care of this beautiful little bunny. And I looked down and it had died in my hands. So maybe that wasn't my gift. Maybe not. Just touching it sort of invoked passing to the next dimension. But I found that with a lot of these predatory mammals, they really would thrive with my care, and I really felt a calling towards them. And being so misunderstood, there's a lot of hunting with these animals. And there's a real hunting culture in America, which I understand. You know, you look at 150 years ago, if you didn't hunt, you didn't eat. Mm. Only now it's more of a hobbyist type thing. And I think it's a sport, if you want to call it that, that needs to start kind of phasing out. We as a culture are changing. You know, we plant crops, we have cattle, we really don't need to go hunting, and we can have that same family bonding going out camping or with a camera.
Or hunting with a camera.
Yes.
And that's something we'll talk about a little bit later, because that's obviously something that Robert has really picked up on, using the camera instead. And of course, we at Estrange Graphic, that's one of the things we do, is that we really encourage, we see the photography is a way of getting out into nature. And, you know, it sort of almost fulfills whatever that deep-seated need is to go out and find something in the wild. I think photography can sort of replace a different type of shooting, I suppose. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. We have a special offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's three issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you'll receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all our products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. I've actually seen you in action in front of a large predatory creature when we were up trapping crocodiles on the Wenlock River. So I think, obviously, you had that ability, or that ability to stay calm, to understand the animal, to not be afraid, and, you know, bucket loads of courage. And was that sort of part of how you came to get together with Steve? I mean, tell us the story of how you met and how it went from that first meeting.
I felt very lucky because I came to Australia with a friend of mine, and just being able to explore this beautiful country, and we caught up with her friends in Brisbane. And when we came to the Sunshine Coast, we were driving back to Brisbane, and I remember it had been a late night and jet lag and all of those wonderful things, and I was asleep in the back seat. And one of Lori's friends said, "Hey, we're going past this little roadside zoo. Do you want to stop in?" And I woke up and looked at it, and it said the Queensland Reptile and Fauna Park. Looked kind of tiny and kind of crummy. And I thought, oh, it's just going to be sad. And then I thought, well, when am I ever going to be here again? So I go, let's just pull in, because I love wildlife and I'll have a look. And I expected I'd see sad little snakes in jars and things. And I walked in, and while it was incredibly tiny, only a couple of acres, it was remarkably clean, and with things like kangaroos just roving around. They weren't in an enclosure at all. And so I found that encouraging. And then, of course, at midday, there was this guy doing a crocodile show, talking about crocodiles, really in a way I'd never thought about. Now, in Oregon, of course, we have no crocodilians. I mean, we have salamanders, and you can pretend, but they sit in the palm of your hand or aren't really a worry. So I hadn't thought too much about them until seeing this man talk about how they're incredibly affectionate to each other, and they're really protective mothers, and attributes I'd really never thought about with crocs. And he was in with this really large crocodile, and he held up a piece of meat, and the croc lunged out of the water, and he fed the crocodile as calmly as I would put a letter in the letterbox, you know? And it was all about the animal. It wasn't, look at me, aren't I amazing? He just couldn't stop talking about how beautiful and wonderful crocodiles were. So after the main show, there was an area called the Environmental Park that was closed to the public except for with a tour. So for an extra $6, you could go on the private one-hour tour. So I joined in with about another 10 or 12 other guests that were there that day, and went on the Environmental Park tour and learned more about what this man did to protect crocodiles. And instead of seeing them get shot, he would catch them and relocate them, hoping to save their lives.
This would be like problem crocodiles in other parts of Queensland or whatever. He'd be called in, would he, to remove a problem croc?
Correct. And he worked with the East Coast Crocodile Management Program. So the government enlisted his voluntary help removing these crocs that might be near a boat ramp or hanging out in an area that was frequented by people or starting to take cattle or any conflict situation.
Yeah.
So this was his passion and love. And I remember screwing up my courage to go say hello to him, because he just had such a passion and flair for wildlife. I really wanted to talk to him more. And as we were talking, he said to me, have you done any work with wildlife? And I said, yeah, I love cougars. And I thought it was so interesting because no one had ever said to me, why? Why do you love cougars? And I thought about it and I said, well, it's pretty incredible that they can kill something much larger than themselves with their mouth. And he looked at me all misty-eyed and said, oh, that's what I love about crocodiles. And at that moment, we had an apex predator bonding moment. And it was really quite special. But I remember thinking, I just had this sense I wanted to build a campfire and hear more stories. So I stayed until the zoo was closed, just hearing stories and talking to what was, of course, to be my husband one day. And Steve was just this wonderful, passionate wildlife enthusiast talking to all 12 of us, you know, about conservation.
And so you left and you went back to America. So what happened next?
Well, I did manage to figure out his marital status before leaving, which was a great relief because one does not know how to ask that.
No.
Yes. So
not in a group of 12 anyway.
No. So he offered to introduce me to his girlfriend, Sue. And although I was quite devastated, I tried to remain brave-faced and said, I would love to meet your girlfriend, Sue. And he called out, hey, Sue, Suey, come over here. And so, of course, here comes this little dog running up, his little staffy. And I thought, well, that's great because he's clearly single. So we exchanged numbers and then I flew home and a week went by and I didn't hear from him. And a couple weeks went by. And by week three, I thought maybe I had misunderstood, but I kind of staunchly wasn't going to call him. And 4 weeks later, this very Australian voice on the phone came through and said, I just wanted to let you know I'm coming for a visit and I'll be there in 10 days. And I thought, well, that's very presumptuous that an amazing woman like myself would still be single. But of course, I was kind of pining over him. And yeah, he came to Oregon in November, which was Thanksgiving time. So he got to meet the whole family.
The whole family.
Amazing.
So things moved pretty quick after that, I believe. So, you still had your cougar wildlife conservation operation going then?
Yes, I did. So with Cougar Country, I took in about 300 animals a year, which was all I could really afford or have time for. And had ran the family business at that point and worked part-time at an emergency veterinary hospital, which afforded me a vet clinic all day that was empty of patients. So I would often go in and do all of my own workups and, you know, radiographs and so forth, and then talk to the doctor that evening about how to treat different animals. And it was a really great lifestyle. And I can remember on the odd occasion I would go out on a date, the two things that always struck me were, first of all, I'd say to someone if they were from another town, just don't get too serious because I'll never move, just so you know. And the other kind of litmus test for any dating situation was often I'd get an animal in that may have been very injured some time ago, and I'd say, I know we're out going out for dinner, but can you just stop by and help me pick the maggots out of this animal's wounds before we go to dinner? And then, surprisingly, I'd never see him again. So having Steve come over and just want to be involved with wildlife was just so unusual to me and breath of fresh air, and just really, he was amazing. And you're absolutely right. After the October meeting and the November visit, I went back to Australia in January and spent about a month here. Mm. And Steve took me to the Burdekin River and showed me croc nests and crocodiles at night on the river. And as you know, it's just such an incredible place to visit. It is like something you would only see in Australian Geographic. And you felt like you were in the most wild of wild areas, and the beautiful melaleuca trees that became so mysterious at night. We'd have our spotlight looking over the river, and this spotlight attracted all the insects, and then the insectivorous bats were hunting the insects in your light, and you'd see the little eye shine of the crocodile out on the water, and it was just a spectacular event. And I learned so much from Steve and had such a new appreciation for the beautiful wildlife and wild places here in Australia. But then we got back to the zoo, and it was like the day before I was leaving, February 2nd. And here at Australia Zoo, there was a big tree that had been hit by lightning and was dead. So it was in danger of losing limbs that may fall on someone. So we fell the tree and incremented it up. And at the end of the day, I was hot and sweaty and tired and disheveled. And we were having a cool drink, just sitting in the shade. And Steve turned to me and said, "So what do you reckon? Do you want to get married?" I was like, "What? Who just said that?"
You passed the test on being able to fell a tree.
And oh, my word. And so here I am all sweaty and leaves stuck in my hair and gross. And yes, there were no candlelight rose petal moments with Steve. He was very to the point. And, you know, I thought of my family and friends and career and wildlife and all the reasons I couldn't leave, and said yes. So it was pretty special.
What a wonderful story, and what a wonderful way to start your life together. Just fast forward from there, because it wasn't too many years later that you had the television series The Crocodile Hunter, and then you found yourselves both on American television, and things went pretty quickly after that, I would imagine, in terms of how Steve just became really a world-famous personality. So tell us a little bit how that came about, where you got the idea to do the TV series. You could obviously see the potential of his amazing kind of passion, personality, and charisma really for television. Tell us the story of how you got onto American television.
We were married in Eugene, Oregon in June, and then we got this call that there was a crocodile that someone was trying to shoot in North Queensland. It had been hanging around a boat ramp, and they said, "If you come and relocate this crocodile, maybe we can save it." So Steve said, "Do you want to have a honeymoon or go save this croc?" And I said, "Absolutely, we'll head back to Australia. No question at all." And Steve had a friend who used to always come into the zoo to film commercials, because if a commercial involved any wildlife, you know, the tortoise for the bank commercial, or the catching a beer by a crocodile for the beer ad or something, Steve was the one who could do it and do it very effectively. And so there was a relationship with someone who filmed, and we just thought, why don't we try filming, going out and experiencing this? And it really was just about Steve. And I came along, even though I didn't know anything about anything, just because the last thing you want to do is get married and then say, "Goodbye, see you in a few weeks." So I just tagged along. And it ended up kind of working for filming because I didn't know anything. So Steve had someone to teach.
To explain what
Correct.
He was doing.
Mm. Correct. So we found the male crocodile, sadly, had been shot before we got there, but we found it. And that in itself told a sad story. And then we managed to catch his female, who was also hanging around the area and we were worried about. And it was such a surreal moment for this crocodile to be in a mesh net. And you have to understand, with crocs, as you know, you can't sedate them. Being reptiles, they metabolize sedative completely different and much slower than a mammal. So you don't want a sedated crocodile going back into the water and being compromised. So it's a matter of physically holding down the animal, doing what you need to do, and getting it back into the wild. So we're going to get the trap off it, this mesh net trap, relocate it in the boat, and let it go in a different river system. And I remember Steve saying to me, and this was a female croc about 9.5 feet long. She's pretty big. And he said, "You jump on the croc and I'll get the mesh off." And you know, it's like you think, maybe I didn't understand, because that just doesn't, you jump on the crocodile? So he said, "Right now, jump on her head." And I'm like, "Ah." So I jumped on the crocodile, and it was utterly,
like, from behind,
kind of three-quarter angle, so she couldn't really see me coming. And then just my forearms across the top of her eyes and holding her head down, following Steve's instructions. And then she wiggled quite a bit, and he helped me. And then I remember her kind of taking a big, deep breath. And I remember her breath on my face just picked up my fringe, and how it was soft and warm and unexpectedly odorless. It didn't smell like fish or meat or bat or anything. And it was just such a beautiful, marvelous experience. And after we got done filming this episode, I thought, well, this is going to be really special for Australian television to show people how wonderful crocodiles are. And Channel 10 here in Australia said, we'd love 10 episodes. So we went back out and continued filming. And Steve and I sat down and said, you know, if we're going to be doing this, we need to figure out how we're going to handle running a zoo and doing this filming. So we decided any money we made from filming, we'd put back into conservation. The zoo would cover our day-to-day costs for living, but this would be something over and beyond what we were earning, and we would just re-donate it back into what we could do to protect wildlife. And I thought, that's great. And then the series did really well, and Channel 10 wanted more episodes. And it was kind of funny because from 1992 to 96, we pretty much made nothing. We just barely covered production and travel costs. And we didn't have to worry about where we were going to put that money at all. So in 1996, the discussion came up about maybe we should look further afield than just Australia. And because I'm the token American, I said, why don't you go to America and approach someone like Discovery? So I flew to the U.S., to Bethesda, Maryland, right by Washington, D.C., in my very best 1980s padded-shouldered power suit, and got there and sat down in this dauntingly huge office room, boardroom. You could have landed an ultralight on the desk, I'm telling you now, with all these people there. And I sat up at the desk and said, we've been filming this wildlife documentary series, and it's doing really well, and it's, you know, very popular in Australia. What do you think? They looked at it, and they said, you know, with wildlife documentaries, it's like 80% wildlife and 20% presenter. And you've got this guy in, like, every single scene, so it's not really a wildlife documentary. So I was wondering what to say, so I said what everybody says. If you just give it a try, I'm sure it would work. So they looked at me very patiently and said, well, this really isn't something for Discovery because we do a very defined wildlife documentary style. But we have this little network called Animal Planet, and it only has 250,000 subscribers. But we could try it on that network and see how it goes. So we all agreed, and then Crocodile Hunter was born on Animal Planet. And 10 years later, they were up to 90 million subscribers. And the credit was primarily to Steve's genuine, authentic style of filming and showing you can hold this rattlesnake and it doesn't want to kill you. Not that you should, or even I should, but that he wanted to dispel the myths around wildlife, that they're not spending their whole time trying to get us. They're just living their own life the way we do. And it was a beautiful moment in time that connected everyone with wildlife. And I think the greatest compliment was when someone would call us and say, there's a hurt animal in our yard. And we'd get there and here it is, the guy up the road in his singlet and stubbies with a beer in one hand and in watching the footy. He's not watching wildlife documentaries. He's not really even a conservationist, but he knew it. He wanted to see this animal helped. And that's what Steve brought to wildlife filming.
Well, that's it for the first part of our interview with Terry Irwin. Don't forget to tune in for the second part. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com. Or find us on Instagram, @Australian Geographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find special offers for our listeners, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait and go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from, so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening. Until next time.